Hello and welcome to the Label Sessions Presents podcast. Label Sessions is the world's leading innovation expert network. In this series, you will meet some of the most interesting leaders anywhere, from across the worlds of business, design, tech, culture, and sustainability, all signed to the Label Sessions roster. To find out more about our work, helping brands and institutions around the world take on their big challenges for the future, head to labelsessions.com to find out more. For now, enjoy the podcast.
Thank you so, so much, Glenn, for coming on the podcast. Really appreciate it and can't wait to dive into kind of UX research and everything like that. So, you know, we know you at Label Sessions as a UX researcher that's all about, you know, bringing qual and quant together as a, you know, mixed methods UX researcher. Super exciting and love to dive into that. But perhaps if you could, you know, share a small introduction, you know, with us about you, your work, and, you know, the backstory that gets you to this point as well.
So I'm Glenn. I'm from Belgium, based in Belgium. And I've been working as a consultant in digital user experience for about 10 years now. I'm working with clients in retail, pharma, tech, like security tech, accounting tech, some NGOs, and I'm most of all, including right now, financial players, people in the financial or in insurance industry. As I said, I'm based in Belgium, but my clients have been in Switzerland, France, the Netherlands, and the United States. My work is really focused, as you said, on performing customer and UX research and establishing the conditions doing that. So I perform it, but I also help companies establish this practice and this culture of keeping doing this themselves. So what I like to say is using research, I help put customer centricity into practice, like make it a reality. All companies say they are customer centric and they mean it when they say it, but it's an intention. A lot of it is a kind of lip service and the practice often isn't there. And if you don't know your customer, then how do you know what to be centric towards? And that's what I try to do. I try to use research to get to know our customers, what drives them, their experience, what it's like, what their unmet needs are. This requires lean but solid research. And then this in turn helps people, helps companies take decisions that take into account the customer and in that way be truly customer centric.
Yeah, and it's so interesting how, you know, it's almost the first step of either building a business or, you know, when a business wants to pivot, yes, they have the customers that they had before, but, you know, some new customers could have come in, you know, societies change, people change. So I think it's super important, not just when starting a business, but the whole journey. But I was wondering, you know, at the moment, you've told us kind of what you're building out, but what's keeping you busy at the moment?
So right now, my biggest client is a financial player, financial institution, based in Belgium and the Netherlands, but active globally. And I do two things. So on the one hand, I'm helping them build their research practice. They've had one. But it's been, in terms of research toolkits, the methods, the operation, it's not been near its potential. So I'm expanding their research methods toolkits. I'm teaching, coaching people and teams using, as you said, indeed, both qualitative, quantitative, with an emphasis on really triangulating to get a better picture from different directions and get more credibility, more trustworthiness in our data to make better decisions. And a key word there is something in research we call validity. It means a lot of things, but the generic meaning is the research method that we're using capable of getting to the insights that we need for this decision? So are we really testing what we aim to measure? Are we measuring what we aim to understand better? And this is important because there are still a lot of researchers who master one or two methods, but then everything tends to look like a nail. And in validity, it's very important that we look closely into the actual research question at hand, the information that we need in order to make better decisions, and apply the best methods. And so this is something we are doing. We are mixing methods. That the one day we are doing in-depth qualitative interviews. The other day we are quantitatively analyzing, doing hierarchical clustering of cards or data. We're looking at it from all angles. And this helps build the understanding step by step every time we do research. The second thing I'm doing for that client, there are a couple of very strategic business objectives that they have, biggest milestone they have this year. And I'm leading the research for those tracks to, well, basically help them understand their target audience better, to bring it closer to them, to de-risk the decisions that they need to take for quite high stakes decisions. And this is common in most of my work. Most of my assignments, I both fish and teach to fish. And I love this combination. I love doing research. I could never go without. I really love coaching people and training large groups of people to do these methods themselves as well, to help product manager get firsthand exposure to the actual user experience and people using their own products.
And out of curiosity, is this what you've always been doing since the beginning, or were you perhaps, I don't know, in a company that you saw it not, been done well, and you're like, if this is a problem here, it must be a problem elsewhere. I wonder, what's the starting story?
The full backstory is actually, I have a master's in law. I never did anything with it because at the time I graduated, so it takes 5 years to reach that master. I was kind of tired of it. So then I didn't know any better and started working for a bank and ended up giving, I quite liked it for a couple of years, so financial advice to mostly business startups. And I loved it. So, but it was pure front office work. So I saw customers every day. So it was really good to build up my understanding of the actual customer experience. But at the same time, in the front office, you're very limited in terms of your actual impact. So as you said, there are a lot of things that the headquarters, back office kind of, they lay down the law, and they do it for good reasons, but they lack local knowledge. It's kind of like Soviet Union, like all is centralized, but then there are actual people seeing customers every day. And there were so many things I wanted to change. So then at some point I was like, yeah, I'm done with this. I'm going to work for headquarters. I'm going to take all of this front office knowledge. And that's exactly how I got rolled into UX. So from there, I started the job as a junior researcher in UX and then just grew from there.
No, I think that's fantastic. And, it really shows that you've been at the front and you've been at the back. You have the plethora of experience that's needed to really and truly understand what goes into making a great experience, I was just super curious about that one. But, thinking about the here and now, I'm sure you're having lots of conversations with clients, but with also other researchers. But what are you excited about right now in your field? Are there any emerging opportunities or, challenges as well that are important or will be important for your work?
First of all, what I'd like to say is that when it comes to large societal or technological trends or marketing new products, that's a nice thing. There's always new things and the customer expectations are changing as a result of that. But one of the things I love most about UX and UX research is that in the end, it is absolutely technology agnostic and it is very, very durable when faced with the passage of time. What I mean with that is that the same principles and methods that were true 30 years ago in terms of human factors, human computer interaction, the psychology of man versus machine, this is deep rooted so deeply in psychology that it is still true today. It will still be true in decades. So I know there's one colleague of mine who likes to say that they go to a company and if they have a user, if they have people who need to use their products, then I can help. Or it's the moment you have people and they need to do something and you want to make it easy for them and desirable, we are here to help. It is truly that agnostic. But then because, of course, the underlying technology keeps changing, it keeps getting exciting and exciting, but also kind of, it makes me skeptical as well at the same time, because without any exception, actually, new technology in its earliest stages has never really been user-centric. It almost always starts out very engineer-centric. We got a new technology, and then it's engineer-driven. And I'm pointing fingers at the engineers, but to be honest, I would point a second finger at the marketeers as well. So we are often faced with technological dreams and marketing fantasy disguised as strategy. It's well meant, but they forget the human factor. And to be frank, you often hear these percentages, and depending on the source, it's 60 or 80. I've even seen 90% of startups or new business initiatives that fail. And then the core reasons always comes down to the market adoption, the user experience. It's all about forgetting the human factors. And that's what we try to do. We put those human factors and we introduce them in the project from the very earliest stages so that we are actually solving problems that are there and that we understand, the context of use. We know the unmet needs so that the chances of success of this business idea are just far greater. And then we test the actual usability. Can people actually use your potential solution before going live with it? So we try to take those risks away and avoid things like, and then this is an example that has been given a lot recently, like the human AI pin or humane AI pin. It was an untested product, and the consequence is clear in what we see today. So on the one side, always exciting. On the other side, we can always fall back on those core principles.
Yeah, and I think, like you said, it comes out a bit to psychology as well. And taking myself out of, you know, as a consumer or as, you know, someone who, as a user, I feel like, you know, just using tech companies, big tech companies can be the cutting edge of XYZ. But if they're trying to appeal to the average person, they need to be able to explain it or, you know, sell it to you in a way that you know, we're solving your problem, not, do you want to be using the high tech? And I'm like, maybe I don't want to be using the most, you know, high spec version. I want to be using something that's going to solve a problem and, you know, that really, you know, meets my needs. So of course, if they're pitching to the people who, you know, that's kind of their audience, but they want the latest and greatest and they're willing to figure it all out, then, you know, that's what they're doing. But if not, you know, they need to know who their audience is, exactly what you're saying. And, you know, the way that you're saying it, I'm like nodding along going, I know, I it makes sense. It very much makes sense.
And the things you've mentioned are very aligned with the principle of the chasm that companies need to cross. And the earliest people who will use it, kind of like the more techie people, are often the early adopters. But it's very rare for a business to actually be a business based only on early adopters. You need to actually reach the market, and that requires a smooth user experience. And the other thing that kind of echoes in what you were saying is the Maya principle by this inventor called Loewi. I hope I pronounced that right. It stands for most advanced yet acceptable. So you cannot innovate too far too soon. People will just reject. So, and that is true. That holds true because we are all creatures of habit. And yes, people love change, but even the people who love change, rarely is the case that people love too much change. And going slow can sometimes actually mean going faster towards success.
And it's like, I'm sure a lot of these companies have their own innovation teams or, you know, who are really pushing the boundaries, but it's almost like you need to take their customers on a journey before, you know, hitting on the face with this is the newest thing. It's like, okay, maybe small steps to get to that. And I'm sure that's kind of the research of what you do. Of, okay, how do we take these customers on that journey?
Yeah, we import those customer insights. We research them directly. And as I said, my approach is as much as possible to increase the exposure of the people inside the company to those actual customers firsthand. And then we make sure that the insights that come from them inform the decisions. And what you said about innovation is true as well. So most companies have an innovation department, but very often in the companies I've seen across industries, those are a handful of people who look at the competition. They look at what are the most modern competitors, often the more disruptive, smaller competitors, what are they doing? And that is one approach. I mean, we need to be very aware of our competitive landscape. So that's a very important job. But I would argue in the end of the day, where true innovation lies is understanding people's unmet needs. What are they trying to do today? What is not getting done as smoothly as it can be? And then innovate towards that. And that's a way to be ahead of the competition. Because honestly, if you're only looking at the competition, at best, you copy them. But big companies are slow companies, so it will take months to a year before you're there. I don't think that is a surviving strategy. At least it's not the only one. But when you combine that with doing foundational upfront research, so you know what your competitors are doing, you know what they're not doing, you know what the people actually need, that's where the magic lies.
And out of curiosity, you know, thinking about your field or fields as a whole, what conversations do you think people could be having that perhaps are not having? Or, you know, what are some important customer trends that are happening that, you know, you think that your colleagues or people in your field could be more excited about?
The answer I have is something that I think both companies and people are excited about, but perhaps not always for exactly the right reasons or with the best considerations. It is AI, which many people are speaking about today. And there are, at least for me, there are two big aspects where when I see AI in my field to a degree that I haven't seen it 2 years ago. So I'm really talking about Gen AI, generative AI. So on the one side, it is how we are, I have clients, and I think most companies are trying to do something similar today, that are trying to integrate Gen AI somehow into their digital products. this is kind of a race going on today, where it's people, it's both a hype and a very sincere search for how can we increase the user experience, the value that people have from our product by adding this. And I love doing that. So one of the clients I'm helping is a scale-up in accounting tech. And they are building a very tailored Gen AI bot that answers very specific questions. And we are looking how to contextually embed it into their mobile and web experience. So very interesting work. The other aspect is applying Gen AI to our own field. And I think that is also where we need to be very, very mindful of what it's actually doing. So there is a more philosophical argument to be made, like, who can better understand a person, like an actual person or not a person? But I think even beyond that, more specifically, I believe that Gen AI, the capacities are often misinterpreted. So one thing I hear a lot is that, oh, it's great to synthesize. It's a summarizing engine. You can feed it large texts, it gives you shorter texts. And then the repercussion of that would be that instead of actually reading our own transcripts and going through them, which is basically how we analyze, which is very important, and we find themes that we uncover, we go back to earlier transcripts, we make connections, we would let an AI do that. Beyond the fact that I think it could be not great for people in my field to not have that experience of doing their own analysis, beyond that, the technical problem is that AI is actually not good at summarizing. So it generates a new text that is probabilistically related. It builds upon it. And very often, because I use it every day. I'm not anti. I use it every day. And I started using OpenAI. I paid for it, so it's more or less decent. And now I stopped doing that. And I've been using Claude, slightly better for my purposes, by Anthropic. But I use it every day, so I see whatever it cannot do. And very often, it completely misses key insights from the transcripts. Or even worse, it just makes up new insights that sound very plausible, but actually weren't there at all. And so there, I believe it's very dangerous. There is a future, and we should try it out today. We don't want to be stuck in the back when everything is advancing, but we have to be very careful with what we're
doing. Yeah, it's being aware of where its boundaries are and where it can help us and where it can't help us, exactly what you were saying. But yeah, I guess with all of these kind of new tech things and perhaps, you're hearing a lot of conversations. I wonder, you're talking to a lot of leaders and, people are asking you how, what are their customers like and, deep diving into all of that. But almost to be reflective on that, what questions do you think leaders should be asking themselves right now? What shifts do you think that they have to be thinking about making?
One thing that never ceases to amaze me, and I'm paraphrasing I think it's Lewis Platt, if I got the name right. He used to be the CEO of Hewlett Packard, the printer and et cetera company. And he said something along the lines as, if HP only knew what HP knows, we would be 3 times as productive or profitable. I failed to remember the exact, but if they only knew what it knows. And what he meant is that there is so much knowledge and insights spread across the company, all of the departments and divisions. It's spread out there and no one really knows what the company knows. So the result is that they take decisions that don't take into account what they know. So it's assumption-based, even though they have the evidence. Or slightly less worse, but still a bit wasteful, they do research into things that they've already uncovered somewhere else. So they do redundant research. And in this case, what's needed clearly is something that keeps the knowledge local, because it needs to be where people make decisions, of course, but allows those local decision centers to have a connection with the collection of knowledge. And that is actually not that difficult. There are repositories, basically libraries, where you can put your research in, all of the insights, and make them very searchable. Give a taxonomy that makes a lot of sense for that company. I think companies need something like the CIA, but not like the agency, but like a Central Insights Alliance, where this makes a lot of sense, and I've rarely seen any company do it. There are A/B testing people, data scientists, data analysts, UX researchers, market researchers, CX people, all completely different divisions, departments, tribes, whatever you want to call them. Very rarely do they really speak a lot with each other to the point of sharing all of their knowledge and triangulating. So it's all divided up. There's no holistic view of the customer. I think that needs to change. I think there needs to be one, like a chief insights officer or something, or a chief experience officer, and have all the insights centralized there, but in a way that's hyper transparent and highly shareable for everyone who needs them.
Yeah, and I think with that, it must be also so difficult when companies are scaling, or you know, there's multiple different geographies involved and stuff like that. But I guess it comes with a culture as well of A, being able to share that and being open and being collaborative. But also I feel like there needs to be a culture of being inquisitive as well. I mean, a lot of people, I'm sure, like get the task that, okay, I just do it. But there needs to be something of like, okay, why don't you talk to other people? Why don't you have these conversations? And you're not all keeping it to yourself. It's like it's that culture of sharing. And yeah, I think, yeah, chief insights officer would be great at that. I'm really curious to see, you know, if there are, or how many companies out there have someone like that, or have someone dedicated to that. Super interesting. And I wonder, you know, pivoting slightly, perhaps, and thinking about you as a leader instead of kind of your industry, we're a bit curious about, you know, how you think and what makes you tick. So, yeah, my first question to you is kind of, you know, how would you want people to describe you and how you make change happen, you know, on your best day?
I've noticed a way I can make change happen in both me and others is by, I want to investigate whatever I'm talking about, understand it from different angles. It's a bit of my lawyer background. And then I motivate, I argument from all sides, the pros and the cons. I try to bring an objective truth, look at the issue from multiple sides. And I've noticed that this can be very compelling and inspiring and really bring people to action, myself included. So I think that is, if I look into how I work, this is one of the things that I can leverage the most in order to get something done.
And I think it's quite nice when it's framed as, you know, a question that needs solving, or like an argument, because then you can, it's almost, you're proving whether it's right or wrong. And there's, you know, there's a side to take. And I feel like it makes decision making a lot easier in that sense, I guess. And kind of, I guess you get a little bit of, you know, it's quite fun proving something right, or, you know, finding insights and proving something wrong, you know.
Yeah. I love it. But a corollary of that is also, you have to be very strong about your convictions, but very easy to convince otherwise when faced with new data. So that, I'm not talking about stubbornness. I would hate to be stubborn. If I am, I'd want to catch myself to that. I don't think I am, though. I think thanks to being a researcher, that's been beaten out, so to speak. Like, it's very difficult to be a stubborn researcher or to be a good researcher who's stubborn. But if you have the data, you're allowed to be very convinced. But then if there is better data, you need to change your mind, your opinion, because the facts are just different and there might be a better decision out there because of that. So I think that's very important too, to be very flexible and listen to others' arguments as well.
When you're getting these facts, I wonder if, you know, you have particular processes that you go through when taking on a new challenge. Is there like a methodology or framework that you follow that, you know, perhaps you can recommend to others? I know that you do that, make a good mixture of, you know, qualitative and quantitative research. So yeah, I wonder what kind of insights can you give to our audience about the process of doing that?
Yeah, I'd love to. And then it's not a secret. So my process is user-centered design. It's even codified in the ISO norms. And it's got a couple of steps that I think make a lot of sense. So it starts with understand the problem from your user or customer's perspective. So understand their context and their actual problem. Understand that. And then based on those user needs, start describing your requirements. So all of a sudden, no longer group guessing workshops to write user stories that are basically made up. Like, no, it's based on actual evidence about actual people, the people you're trying to serve. So that's already great. Those are the first two steps. Then we take those requirements based on those user needs and we build a solution. We don't release it yet because we're not sure that it's actually good for people. So the last step is then we test this solution pre-launch, pre-life. We test it with actual potential target users and we see if they can use it for the task at hand. And if that is also, that happens to be the case, very often it's not, and we iterate, we improve. Again, all pre-code, so on the cheap, fast. We iterate, we improve, we test again. And then if it's good, we can be fairly confident because we know there is a real problem. We have a solution to that problem, and we know that the solution is usable for the people with that problem. And then we can release it, and then the learning doesn't stop. Because very often that on to the next project, but actually that's where we get the actual market data of the actual real world usage. And we can still keep learning from that data, doing perhaps A-B testing, in-app live surveys, like intercept right when they're doing the thing that interests us, or interview a couple of people who've used it and ask about or show let them show us how they're using it. So the learning never really stops, but it becomes a very iterative, very lean type of learning. So everything I'm talking about is very, it's all very aligned with the modern way of building products in an agile development way. It's all very possible. And the thing it does, following this process, which again has been out there for decades, it's much older than design thinking. It will remain in existence much longer than design thinking because it's just the core. Understand the problem, build the solution, test it, release it. That is it. And endless repeating of that. The second, not really a process, but kind of a dogma for me, which I have still, I don't have any case where it didn't turn out to be true. It is a business makes money by serving people. So that's my mindset. If we understand what people need and we provide it to them, then they will change their behavior in ways that ends up benefiting the business. From there, it becomes a monetization issue. But if we do something that people need, that's where you can start. And any deviation to this has been either deceptive patterns or failures of business models or a lack of alignment of the value of the business where it's over-optimized at the detriment of the user. It's something you saw, and some might say still see, with social media, where everything was optimized for lots of clicks, extreme engagement short-term, at the cost of long-term retention and profitability. So that for me is very important. And I use that very simple duality, like good for the user will end up being good for the business in all of my work.
I think that's so important. And always kind of diving into the way you do it. So I know at Label Sessions, it was really picked out that you use both, you know, the qualitative and quantitative methods and kind of getting that kind of data. But I wonder, is that something that you find is not done a lot other places? So, you know, when you look about, you know, how things are being done, for example, I guess, where do you see the opportunities to reinvent that for the better?
Yeah, for sure. I see either mixed methods, so which could be one person like me who applies both qual and quantitative methods to a business problem, a challenge, as well as larger teams who have the luxury of having qual experts and quant experts. But I see that combination absolutely as the way to go, both today, and I think in the future it will become much more the way, because we need both. One isn't better than the other. They're stronger together. So very basically, there are holes to shoot in my explanation that I'm going to give, but very basically, qual teaches us things that we don't yet know. So it can still surprise us. It fills our knowledge. It learns us new things. It allows us to build theories. Very ground up, bottom up. And then quant tells us how much, how often is that happening. So you learn a new user need through qual, and then you use quant to scale. How many people in this population have this user need? How profitable can this become? So having both is exactly what businesses need. It allows you to discover what's needed and then build a business case around that and know who to serve better, what the differences are between people. So this is how I like to work the most. Another reason where I use both qual and quant, looking purely at UX and usability, we will use qualitative to, let's say we have a brand new design and we're really doubtful of whether it will work well for people, which we often are, or at least should be. So then we test it with some people, moderated qualitative. We see them use it and it teaches us new things. It teaches us, in this case, the usability problems. We see it happening. We hear them think aloud and see them hear them like, wait, where is this? I'm trying to find it. But so we hear the struggle. The designer is there as well because I've kind of forced the designer to observe so they can see it firsthand. And then they iterate the design. And then at some point we're like, yeah, this is good, but we have perhaps two designs and we don't know which is best. They both kind of worked. Or we want to have some evidence that it's going to be better than the current design that's live. this is not a great research question to try and solve qualitatively, because you're really comparing. So we're talking about, we need a statistically significant difference to be sure. So that's where quant comes in. We can then, instead of testing it with a couple of people qualitatively, put it in front of a couple of hundreds of people. Both versions will be tested, either by the same or different groups, depending on exactly what it is we want to learn. And then we can simply see which metrics are the best. We can quantify the usability in terms of success metrics, the time it takes people, or the ease of use they ascribe to it, and then come up with a statistically significant difference for one or the other. And if that points out that our new variant is faster, better, leads to higher success rates and more user satisfaction, then that's a pretty compelling case to make to the leadership that, hey, if we release this, good things are going to happen. So, yeah, I would never want to choose just one. And qualitative was my first love. But these last couple of years, I've taught myself how to code, how to analyze. I love both a lot. And I would never want to work with just one of them. And I truly believe that businesses also really need both of them.
No, fantastic. And I think the way that you explain it, again, made a lot of sense about it almost goes to the argument thing that you're talking about before, about creating an argument, creating a hypothesis and then testing it out as well with both. And the different uses for the different types of data, which is wonderful. But yeah, I guess kind of, you know, to round off this episode of the podcast, we have a few final quickfire questions to ask you. The first one I find really interesting. So, you know, do you think your friends could explain what you do well?
Because I've heard them try it, and then it will depend. So some will emphasize the industry I happen to be working in at that point. Other will say something about it being research. Other will emphasize the digital design. And others will ask, wait, aren't you a lawyer? Because they've forgotten the fact that I've never really done anything with it. But that amount of facets to my job is exactly what I find is interesting about it. That is the beauty of UX research, that it contains so much.
Perhaps quite an easy leading on question though. If you were to give them like a cheat sheet about, you know, what to say when people are asked, what would you want them to say?
Honestly, I'm very happy with how they're doing it today. because again, I think that's one of the features, not a bug of my job, that it is not very easy. It's actually a bit of a running joke on like UX conferences. Very often, like, how do you explain UX to your grandma? Like, it is notoriously difficult. I do kind of think that perhaps business analysts or agile coaches, or I think we are not alone in explaining our job and the difficulties that come with that. But I see it as a feature more than a bug.
My next question to you is, what's the best advice you've ever been given?
It was my first team lead, and he was an avid runner before I was. And his advice would just be to run it off. And I've been doing that. So when I run, it is without music, without ears in. I find it very difficult. One of my attention points is to just not be like stimulated by stuff around me all the time. And so for me, running is almost a meditative experience. And the interesting thing is that you start running, and at first, of course, your thoughts are just running amok. But then that all fades. That just goes away. It becomes silent. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, you're in this zone. And you just, every step, I do also go running exclusively in like parks or forests. I never go running in the street. I don't think I could have the same benefit there. It really needs to be like a park or forest where I could almost run blindly without any danger. Like I could just, so yeah, that's something I love and that gives me.
Where you can really switch off as well.
I switch off, nice. Yeah, absolutely.
My next question to you is, what perhaps is one thing that you couldn't live without?
I love to push myself. I love to try out new things. So, and that is both physically and mentally. So physically, it could be something like teaching myself how to hold a handstand for longer than 10 seconds. I'm still practicing. Mentally, I used to be super into quantum physics. I wanted to understand everything. But then the more I understood, I will never understand everything about it. It's impossible. Right now, I'm really pushing myself to become much better at coding. I want to be... I can do enough to do my analysis, but it's all very applied coding. I really want to be a programmer, someone who can just build stuff. So that's another thing. And there will always be something that I want to learn. And I quite like that. I mean, there are a lot of critique I would give to myself, but that is one, I love that aspect. And I would encourage other people. I love the same thing with my grandparents. So they are, whenever they are trying out something new, they become, it helps them. And then there are psychological explanations about this. Like our brains just atrophy, actually, when we no longer stimulate them. And this is part of the aging process. It's a bit, people stop learning new things. And so if you see the brain as a muscle, which it isn't, but just in this analogy, and if you don't train the muscle, it will atrophy. And my grandmother, I think she's 84 right now. And she quite recently became very good at using a smartphone, but like really good at it. Before it was just like, I just need to know how to call. But now she's like the most active person in the WhatsApp family group. And she's making pictures and voice recordings. So that is awesome. That's a really good mentality. I love it. I hope I will be like that as well when I age.
I have one more question for you. It's a question that is asked to everyone on the podcast. It's a bit of a weird one. It kind of gives us an insight into a little bit more about you. So, Len, on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you and why?
To know whether I'm weird or like if someone else is weird, that would require knowing what is normal, right? I mean, weird being a deviation from normal. So I would probably look at others. So yeah, this question is kind of, I already sense it messing with my head. Because if I look at others, I will be looking at others that I know fairly well. So that's kind of my reference field bias. And then of course, when I look at myself, I know a bit more of myself than I know of others. I know my thoughts. I know what I do in private. I don't know that about others. So I might overestimate other people's normalcy because I don't know what they do in private or in their minds. So that's another problem. There is a bit of Dunning-Kruger effect, you know, where if I'm truly weird, would I then be able to gauge my own weirdness? So the self-reported weirdness and then the scale of 1 to 10, what is 1, what is 10? I'm experiencing it at the moment, like some social desirability. We have this in participants as well, where we are very mindful of them. People always try to come across as good, smart, sane people. So here I will probably want to give an answer that people, I probably want to give like a 7, like weird enough to be interesting, but not so weird that it is scary. But I think in conclusion, the fact that I'm extremely overanalyzing this question and giving it a research treatment probably says enough about my weirdness.
I think I like that. There's not many people that I've talked to that have really deep dived in the way that you did about the more questions that come out from it. So no, I absolutely love that. And yeah, I think it gave us a good insight into your mind and the way you think. So I think that the question did exactly what it was meant to.
Good to hear.
But yeah, I guess with that, you know, I've asked all the questions that I wanted to. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on and, you know, talk to us a little bit about, you know, UX and the things that are exciting you and the things that are interesting to you. I certainly learned a lot, having not known a lot about the intricacies of UX, and it's really interesting to see the way that you think about problems. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you a lot for the questions. I appreciated it as well.
As we close out another episode, make sure to like, subscribe, and follow us on our social channels. Want to access Label Sessions for your brand? Whether you want to build new products, access world-class mentors for your team, or reinvent the way you attract talent into your business, visit Label Sessions to find out more.